You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So we are very lucky and pleased to have with us today Professor David Post from the Beasley School of Law at Temple. David is an extraordinary character in the field of cyber law. When you think actually of the framers of the field, as long as we're talking about Jefferson, he's one of them. And among his kind of arsenal of secret weapons to analyze stuff is the fact that he's an anthropologist. So he's sort of a spelunker that encounters cyberspace, and unlike the rest of us, where we just are like, cool, and like start playing World of Warcraft and drooling, he starts studying and noting, and here's what people are doing. This space actually might be significant. And he saw its significance in the mid-1990s, a time when it was by no means taken for granted. And he and David Johnson wrote multiple articles, but one seminal article that kind of lay down the track for one pole of thinking about the internet that said there's something here, it's something different, it's something exceptional, and we should pay close attention to what's happening and even think about how it will be governed and not assume that states are just going to govern it the way they govern everything else. It's a token of the power of that article that it took, I think, Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu approximately 10 years to write a response to it. You can read their book. The book is titled Who Controls the Internet? The answer is upside down on the back page, but I don't want to tell you what it is. Although I suppose if one had to put that book on a bumper sticker, it would be states have guns and you don't. David's book is much harder to encapsulate on a bumper sticker, and that's a real credit to it. It is, in the genuine and most flattering sense, a series of notes, and not just in homage to Jefferson's notes, but truly a sense of impressions that cover the many years David has spent trying to figure out this stuff. So our basic format is he's going to speak maybe for about 20 minutes and fill us in on the general sweep of the book, and then we'll have a discussion and see where it goes from there. So, David, great. Welcome.
Thank you. So, it was nice of you to say that I represented one pole of thinking, Jonathan.
By that, you mean it's not nice of me to say that.
No, it was nice of you to say that. You could have said something less nice. So I know my job.
By which you mean it wasn't nice, but it could have been worse.
I guess that's what I meant. I see. I know my job here is to sort of summarize my book. I'm supposed to wave it in front of you, so. To sort of try to summarize this book, and to do so in such a way that for those of you, most of you who are, I assume have not read it, will find something coherent and interesting in what I'm saying, but also interesting to those of you who have read it. I wouldn't want to punish you for having read the book by giving you something boring, and which also, of course, implants the desire in those of you who are in the first category who have not read it to immediately rush out and buy it and read it immediately. It is, as Jonathan said, it really is a hard book to summarize in sort of, 6 pages, 15 minutes. If I could do that, I would have not written a book, I would have written a blog posting. The book actually started as a kind of a blog posting before there were blogs. 1995, I posted a little essay on the Electronic Frontier Foundation website, which was sort of the newfangled website in 1995, entitled Jefferson in Cyberspace. And as I worked on some of those ideas over the years, I found that I couldn't tell the story I wanted to tell in a blog posting, which is why I wrote a whole book. It's hard to summarize because it's not really an argument. If it were an argument, I could give you, I'm a lawyer, I can make arguments, and I would give you the main points, the main heading, and tell you what the conclusion is, and then we could have a discussion about that. But it's not an argument, it's a perspective, a new way, I think, of looking at things. The internet in particular, although not just the internet. The perspective gets built up piece by piece over the course of the book, and it either adds something up to something coherent by the end, or it doesn't. And I leave that to you, the reader, to judge. But I can't take you through that in 15 minutes. I can't build up that perspective for you in 15 minutes. It would be going by too quickly. It would be very disorienting. The perspective, of course, that I'm trying to build up is Jefferson's. And I guess you could say, you know, if I can really pull that off, if I can describe what the internet looks like through Jefferson's eyes, the ideas that he would bring to the table about it, the features he would think are important or unimportant in it, the solutions he might propose for bringing law to it, if I could really pull that off, I mean, how could that not be interesting? You know, as an aside, Jefferson has taken he's taken sort of a bad rap over the last decade or so. A lot of people dismiss him out of hand. He's the dead white guy with the slaves. And I think it's a mistake, actually. It's one of the sort of subtexts in the book, to dismiss him out of hand. He's no saint, but I'm not looking for saints. I'm looking for good ideas. And Jefferson had a lot of good ideas. He had some really terrible ideas, too. But we can pick and choose among his ideas. He's got an enormous amount to teach us because he was a really smart guy. You know, there's a wonderful John F. Kennedy quote you've probably heard about Jefferson at a dinner at the White House honoring 49 Nobel Prize winners. Kennedy said it was the greatest collection of talent ever gathered in that place, with the exception of when Jefferson dined alone. Jefferson is, you know, the fox knows many things and the hedgehog knows one big thing. Jefferson's the only person I can think of, possibly Darwin being the other, who was both one of the great hedgehogs in history and one of the great foxes, propounder of some of history's greatest big ideas, and simultaneously one of the world's leading experts on cartography and viniculture and canal building and plow design and linguistic evolution and meteorology and so on and so forth. He does not have all the answers. He may not have any of the answers. But he was asking the right questions, I think. And we could do worse than to try to figure out what those questions were and to ask the same questions ourselves about our new world. Now, I've been working on these questions about internet law and governance and so on for about 15 years, and I persist in thinking that we face really hard, they're really hard questions. And I need all the help I can get from Jefferson or anyone else in figuring them out. The internet is really a hard thing to think about. How does it work? Who built it? What is it exactly? And where is it exactly? And is it a place? We talk about it as if it's a place, but we know it's not really a place. It's, well, what? Who runs it? Whose law governs it? Those are, I think, many of them profoundly difficult questions. So what do we learn about them? Those are the questions I'm interested in. What do we learn about them by looking at them through Jefferson's eyes? Well, again, if I could tell you, I would just tell you. I'm not trying to hide the ball, but I couldn't tell you in less than the 223 pages or whatever of this book. Sort of a long story. Not that long, but too long for a 15-minute talk. But I can give you the flavor of what I'm trying to do by answering the first question that everybody asked about the book, which is, what's up with that moose? In search of Jefferson's moose. We've got emails from friends saying, gee, I'm embarrassed to say, you know, I don't know what Jefferson's moose is. Well, that's okay. Some of you may know the story, but many of you may not. Jefferson, in 1787, Jefferson has the complete carcass and skeleton and antlers of a male moose, 7 feet tall at the shoulders. Did you get that on the? 7 feet tall at the shoulders, shipped to him in Paris, where he was serving as the American ambassador, reassembled, and then placed in the entrance hall of his residence. Now, it's an amusing little episode. It's Jefferson at his most lovably eccentric. And if you saw the film a few years ago, Jefferson in Paris, they actually had the moose on display in the back of one of the scenes. But lovable eccentricity aside, what was he up to? what did he care about and why did he care so much about it to go to the trouble, which was considerable, and the expense, which was also considerable, to do this, to bring a moose to Paris. And in 1787, when he had a lot of other things going on, 1787 was a turning point year in human history. France is collapsing. In the United States, the Constitutional Convention is beginning. Jefferson is the only man on the planet who's actually involved in both of those events through his sort of international network. And in the midst of all this, he brings a moose. He arranges to have this moose shipped to him in Paris. He called the moose in a letter to a friend an acquisition more precious than you can imagine. You know, what was he up to? And was he serious? It turns out he was serious, and he was up to something important. He was trying to understand the principles of scale, the laws governing the growth and the size of things, how you make small things big and big things small. He shipped a moose to Paris because he was having an argument about scale, a debate about the relative sizes of New World versus Old World animals. A number of European scientists, the very best of them actually, had advanced a theory that animals in the New World were actually smaller, sort of degenerate versions of their cousins in the Old World. Jefferson thought the theory was hogwash, as true as the fables of Aesop, he said. And he spent a huge amount of time over a 10-year period refuting the theory. And the moose, the largest of the known New World quadrupeds at the time, along with the bison, but Jefferson couldn't get a bison. The moose was the coup de grace, as it were, the final nail in the coffin for this degeneracy theory. He invited all the scientists into his house and said, degenerate animals in the New World. Now, it turns out he was right. Animals don't get, on this debate, animals do not get systematically smaller in the New World. But really, so what? Why should I care? Why should you care about that? The reasons I should care and you should care about that is because the principles of scaling really are of profound importance. And we, at least those of us who think about law and society and public policy, don't think enough about scale. Biologists think a lot about scale. Architects think a lot about scale. Map makers think a lot about scale. And of course, not coincidentally, Jefferson was a great biologist and a great architect and a great map maker. The study of size and scale helped Jefferson solve one of history's great scaling problems. It was called the problem of the extended republic, sometimes called Montesquieu's law. It went something like this: republican government couldn't scale. Government by the people, government in which the governed control their governors, could only work in small communities. You could never get it to work over large territories. Many people, including many very smart people, Alexander Hamilton among them, who was no dummy, believed that and thought that the 13 United States might already be too big for republican government to succeed, let alone the expanse of new territory that came into the country's hands after the War of Independence, let alone the new territory that Jefferson added with the Louisiana Purchase. The Whiskey Rebellion of the 1780s was sort of proof to Hamilton and others of that. We were having trouble controlling the area around Pittsburgh, for crying out loud, let alone any larger expanse of territory. Jefferson thought Montesquieu's law was hogwash, too, and he spent much of his life trying to figure out how to scale up republican government and the institutions of republican government so that they could span an entire continent, and he did. He did figure it out. It was largely Jefferson's plan that guided U.S. expansion westward and the administration of the territory west of the Alleghenies. And if you don't know the details of the plan or the story of how he did that, read the book. It's a masterstroke. It's extraordinary. And it helped bring about something that was unthinkable to most people in the 1780s, namely a republic covering a territory so big from Atlantic to the Pacific that nobody in the 1780s had the slightest idea how big it was. The only thing more incredible than the plan he came up with to scale up Republican government is that most of it actually did come to pass. So when it comes to questions of scale, he was up to something, and it was something important. And it turns out that questions of growth and scale are of really deepest importance for our understanding of the net, because the internet is a phenomenon that's defined entirely by scale. This is a simple point, but it's one I find that it can be hard to grasp. There are hundreds of thousands of internetworks, dozens of different ways to build an internetwork and connect it together. One of those internetworks in the 1980s started growing at a prodigious rate and kept growing out of nowhere. That's the one we call the internet. It's the big one, the one that managed to keep growing till it spanned the globe. As I think this is I regard this as the best sentence in the whole book, personally. It's not big because it's the internet, it's the internet because it's big. Understanding the net means understanding how it grew so fast and got so big, how it scales, because that's why it became the internet. The internet adds, it still is adding 10,000 blogs a day. How does it manage that? Why did it grow so fast and not some other network? We need to understand the principles of scale on the net for many reasons. Let me give you three of them, or summarize three of them. We need to understand principles of scaling on the net, how it grows, because it's not foreordained that it can keep growing. This is, I think, related, maybe we can talk about this later, is related to some of the points Jonathan makes in his book, Future of the Internet, I think. We're not going to wake up tomorrow and the internet won't be there. That would be odd. But we might wake up tomorrow and find that it can't carry the load anymore, that it can't keep doing what it has been doing so well up to now. If the internet were a bridge that was carrying 10,000 cars a day, it would be, I think, intuitively obvious that, well, maybe it can't carry, just because it can carry 10,000 cars a day doesn't mean it can carry a million cars a day or a billion cars a day or 10 billion cars a day. The internet is like that. It's not just the capacity, the size of the pipe, but it's the ability of the net to continue to add capacity, the processing power that's required to keep growing. I talk about some of these scaling issues in the book. They're serious. Among other things, we are possibly running out of internet addresses at the moment, running out of numbers, which will be a scaling ceiling that could be quite serious in the very near future. Now, of course, you might think, well, it's just like a bridge. I don't know how many cars can go over the Charlestown Bridge, but I assume, you know, the chief engineer knows, and they're taking care of it, and they're on top of that. But of course, on the internet, there's no chief engineer. There's nobody who is on top of it in that way. There's nobody who runs it. There's nobody who's in charge. The second reason we need to think about the principles of scale and scaling on the net is that we have to start asking questions about how law scales. We need a vocabulary and an analytic for talking about scaling of law. There are many things wrong with copyright law these days that make it really ill-suited for the networked ecosystem. One of them is it doesn't scale. Cyberspace is a place where you can't turn around without implicating and involving copyright protection. Pretty much everything out there is protected by copyright. And everything gets copied dozens and dozens of times as it makes its way across the internet. Copyright law breaks down at this scale. I use the example of, well, some of you have seen like these Songsmith videos that are being posted on YouTube. I know if I were Larry Lessig, it would now be playing behind me. It would just magically appear and it would be up, but I'm not. Songsmith videos, you put together a video of Marvin Gaye singing, and you take a pre-recorded track of the Beatles' All You Need Is Love, and you add onto that the Songsmith generated genre guitar and drum background, so you get this weird version of what looks like Marvin Gaye singing All You Need Is Love in like lounge lizard style. So, yeah. The analysis, there are hundreds of thousands of these have now been posted on YouTube. Some of them are awful, as you can imagine. Some of them are really quite extraordinary. The analysis of the copyright implications of even one of these videos It's not impossible, but it's a good 10 hours worth of work. I'm a good copyright lawyer, and I would give you an estimate of 10 to 20 hours of work just to figure out whose copyright is involved in any one of these videos. Even if the creator wanted to comply with copyright law and came to me and said, tell me what I need to do, we're talking about a 10 or a 20 hour job. All for a work that might have taken 15 minutes to create. That's the problem. Multiply that by 100,000 for each of those videos that's posted on YouTube, and multiply that probably by 100 or 1,000 for all of the videos that are being made that are not posted on YouTube, and you have a system that is profoundly wasteful. Copyright, remember, is supposed to be incentivizing creators, but in fact, the only way these works get created is if people quite reasonably ignore it completely, because it's too costly, it's too complex to work at this scale. It's not doing its job anymore. But we don't have a good way to talk about that. I think it's become sort of problematical. We don't have a vocabulary to really analyze that and to think about that. The third reason we need to understand scale and think about more about scale is that, like Jefferson, we face on the net scaling problems in the design of our institutions for governance and governing. Jefferson helped to scale up Republican institutions so that they could span a continent. It was a remarkable achievement on continental scale. And we need to do something similar, I think, for the net. The internet is a global phenomenon, like it or not, and we need to scale up our institutions once again, this time to global scale. It's a profound challenge, and I don't pretend to know how to do it. I don't know that anybody knows how to do it. I don't see an enormous number of good ideas floating around about how to do it. You know, the UN, I guess, why not? Maybe. That's when you talk about international places, that's kind of the only ideas we have. I'm not saying that Jefferson's ideas, which I go into in detail, obviously, in the book, I'm not saying Jefferson's ideas are the right ones. Maybe they'll work again. Maybe they won't. But we really need collectively to start working on this and trying to figure this out. So I really see the book as the start of that conversation. Let's see, a couple more words. Yeah, if none of this makes you want to read this book, I can hardly imagine how that could be true, but if so, if none of this makes you want to read this book, how about this? The omens are with me. How do I know the omens are with me? The zeitgeist. And you all want to be on top of the zeitgeist, right? As those of you who know me know, I did most of the work on this book, almost all the work on this book, in Vermont, where I spend my summers. It's about 12 summers worth of work. The day I send off the final version of this manuscript, and I swear on my mother's grave that this is true, I wouldn't say that if it were not, the day I send off the final, I've gotten the copy-edited version from the publisher, I've made my corrections, I drive to the post office, it's the last time I'm gonna see this text that I've been working on for most of my professional life until it's in hard copy. I send it off. I drive back and there is a male moose standing in front of my house. I swear it's true. The first one I had seen in 20 years in southern Vermont. And he stands there for a day and a half. He stays for a day. Everybody in the neighborhood driving up and down the road, calls me up all weekend long. Hey, you know what's in your meadow? You got this male moose in the meadow. I swear that's true. Now I know. There are no omens anymore. It's just a coincidence. A week after the book is published, news comes that they are digging the foundation. You can look this up. You all got net connections. They're digging the foundation for the new Thomas Jefferson Law School in San Diego. And they're digging the, you know, excavating the foundation. And what do they find underneath but the complete fossilized skeleton of a mammoth? Under the mammoth, there is a 40-foot baleen whale, 600,000 years old. And 2 days ago, I just got something that said, under the whale, I swear, there is a sloth, a giant ground sloth, of the same genus that Jefferson described in a 1797 paper to the American Philosophical Society.
So it's basically Jefferson's turducken.
Exactly. It's turtles all the way down, we were told, but now I'm not so sure. I don't know what's going to come under the... But here I go, and I write this book that is all about Jefferson's rather mad obsession with size and scale, which is organized completely around his search for really big animals. And they go and they find a whale and a mammoth and a giant ground sloth under the Thomas Jefferson Law School, and you don't want to read my book? Anyway, so read my book. That's my 20 minutes. I turn it over to the
chaos. And we should note that there are copies of the book available in the back of the room, and David will sign them.
I'll do whatever you want, actually.
He'll sign it with anyone's name. Or perhaps you can sign it Thomas Jefferson.
If you want me to.
People.
Sure.
Indeed, indeed. So, questions, reactions?
You may have to keep
I'm going to start with one. As I alluded to somewhat apparently awkwardly in the introduction, you've vindicated what has become a really distinct strand of thinking in the kind of stylized intellectual debates that followed on the state of the internet and its future. And I wonder, just as we might say Jefferson was privileged to live at a time of frontier, of huge shifts in space and the notion of a frontier, that he was trying to convey back to the old world and even try to understand and build a governance structure around in the new world. Mm-hmm. That's over now. We now live in a, you know, boring administrative state that bears perhaps not as much resemblance as we might think to those halcyon early yeoman or yo-person farmer days. Is cyberspace undergoing a similar transformation where at one point it was new and limitless and just there's the frontier for us to define, but now it's becoming its own flavor of suburbanified?
Yeah, and no. not if we can keep it growing. And to coin a phrase, generative. Zittrain's phrase, of course. Those of you
it might know. Actually be yours. It was that nice workshop
mine,
in Philly.
Richard,
that...
Thank you. Right. But you use it in your book. But no, really, not if we... I mean, some of this is... there's a self-fulfilling nature to some of these ideas. It's very important, in a sense. If everybody believes it's a boring, suburbanized, and appliance-sized place, then, in fact, that is what it will become. I think it's very hard to break out of that circle. One of the points of the book is to remind people that it doesn't have to be that, or it isn't that. It is a continuously expand. There's always, for things that are growing, there's always a frontier out at the edge where one can find new things that have not been developed before. I think it's a little bit early to ring the death knell for cyberspace and innovation and... I think it's way too early, actually. I think you would agree. Mm. I think that there's plenty of innovative communities being formed, there are innovative applications being developed all over the place, and so it continues to be the frontier. It's why it is a Jeffersonian place because it has the energy of the frontier behind it, and I think the task is to keep. If it does not keep growing, then it will lose that, and it will sort of solidify and harden into something that I think would be a real lost opportunity for us.
Yochai.
Oh, Yochai. Oh, there he is.
Pleasure to hear you. But,
hit the button so it'll go on the webcast.
I was a little baffled by the last turn to the UN, and I don't know whether it was tongue-in-cheek, whether it was... an actual search, not for the UN, but for something that is a well-articulated international structure in some treaty form or this, that, or the other. Because, again, it strikes me that central to your metaphor is that what made the Republic scalable was its loosely coupled system. What made... certainly the Jeffersonian Republicans of the early 19th century so focused on yeoman farmers was, were relatively independent, loosely coupled, etc. Right. Needless to say, that's what made the net grow as it grows. Needless to say, you had, let's just say, a role in defining the idea of internal jurisdictions within cyberspace that identify their own spaces. What is the shape of this international system that's not UN, that's presumably more grown up than cyber jurisdictions, but that retains this loosely coupled system?
Fair question, to which I will make my first response is I really don't know. That's, you know, I'm no Jefferson, I guess. You know, that I can't take it all the way out. I don't know what this looks like. That's why it's a conversation, actually. I think if people are thinking intelligently about it, we have some hope of coming up with something that I can't come up with on my own. But we were talking about this at Berkman just before. You know, one model are these, you know, there are communities on the net that see themselves as sort of nascent law-making places. Wikipedia is one. Some of the virtual worlds are others, in which if people believe, people can become engaged civically, if you will, in those communities and take them seriously as places where, at least in a narrow sphere, law gets made. It is not too far-fetched for me to think about groups of those communities joining together into larger and larger aggregations, and at some point coming to the table and saying, we deserve respect as a lawmaking community. Where that happens and how that happens, I'm not sure. But it could be in court, for example, where there has been some adjudication in one of these virtual spaces that has decided about a property dispute. And somebody comes to a real space court and says, I don't like the result, I'd like you to overturn it. And the court says, why? They did a reasonable, you know, we respect the judgments of the courts of Saudi Arabia and Thailand and Malaysia and France because they meet certain the minimum requirements, I guess. And if these communities have come up with institutions like that, why shouldn't we give them credence as well? And I think that's a moment at which you can say there's community lawmaking on the net. That's a new kind of lawmaking place.
But I wonder to what the extent the metaphor of Saudi Arabia as opposed to a corporation, a contractual arrangement. I'd say a way of describing the way in which, say, the free and open source software community is governing itself mm-hmm. is very much by building on the affordances of private law in certain jurisdictions that are particularly powerful, as it were, in terms of the number of players, or arbitrage, resistance, kaza goes back to the Netherlands. So you have a very coherent, progressive view as opposed to a very radical, subversive, mixing and matching private law institutions with just resistance and forum shopping and just muddling through in this frontier way, mm-hmm. which seems to describe what's been, and unless the whole thing comes collapsing because they shut off the pipes of generativity, that seems, what's not sustainable about that?
The muddling through? Nothing is not sustainable about the muddling through. We can continue to muddle through, quite seriously. With the possible worries about the sort of scaling problems that are going to be there that I think are very serious and will need to be addressed in some form or other. But muddling through, we are missing the opportunity to build something that I think is truly extraordinary, more extraordinary than what we have in terms of the ability of people to form communities and make the laws under which they want to live. That's what I think. I think we miss, and we miss the muddling through alternative has this enormous opportunity cost, it seems to me, of the inability to know ex ante what the law is governing any particular transaction. So I go out to some virtual world and I sell you a sword and you pay me some currency, and neither of us knows from whence the other one came, neither of us knows which law might ex post be applied to this transaction. We can muddle through, of course, right, exactly. We can muddle through under that, but I think we're missing the opportunity. We won't get large-scale undertakings as easily in a world that is unpredictable like that. I think law has a function to serve, and it's not really serving that on the net well at the moment. I guess that's my... So, and we muddle through it, we'll miss out on something that could exist, that could be of, holds out some additional promise for, among other things, real wealth creation. I think that's harder to do in an area where law is uncertain.
Subtitle of the book, Making Money on the Internet.
I thought that was the subtitle of your book. Well, wait, it was your book.
Professor Ohm.
I'm actually not of this institution. I happen to be in town, but it's a real pleasure to hear you because I'm part of a generation of cyber profs who started in law school 10 years ago thinking, he's not right, and I'm going to be able to prove that he's not right, and I haven't yet. I'm most of the way through the book, one thing I will say in advance for those of you who haven't read it is it's really two books because the footnotes are this fascinating conversation with you and this peer into how your brain works, and that was so enjoyable for me. You say in the introduction, this is my question, that you're not going to, this isn't a book of scholarship, and you're not in a self-conscious way going to debate scholars, but you do at the end take on what you call the unexceptionalists. There's an entirely different strain of argument that you don't engage, and I wonder if you could tell us why you chose not to. And that's kind of this idea that we make mistakes when we talk about the internet as a monolith, instead of noting that there's a lot of variety, at least on two axes, the differences between the layers, and then the differences between various applications. And so the question, I guess, for your book is, you make lots of arguments about scale by looking at things like routing and DNS, but I don't really understand the mechanism that then suggests that this is a problem at the application layer, right? I mean, you've convinced me that it's probably a good thing we didn't intervene too much with the routing question, but I'm not sure that translates directly into the application layer. I'm really of the anti-monolith school that thinks, no, they're very different lessons. These are very different spaces, and we should consider them as such.
I guess one response, I'm not sure this is responsive, but maybe. For example, the Wikipedia, not as an intellectual property event, as it were, but as a governance event. Thinking about Wikipedia, thinking about the scaling of the administration and the operation of Wikipedia. I'm no expert, and I don't know an enormous amount about it, but my sense is that it's actually running up against a scale problem. It may solve that scale problem, but it's having difficulty at the scale it now operates, which was, of course, inconceivable 5 years ago, even. At the scale it now operates, it's growing too fast. Its frontier is very difficult to control, and the spammers come in, and the people change the sites, and they do all the terrible things, and they're sort of chasing them down. And it is not entirely clear, I think, I don't have a position on this, but it seems to me it's not entirely clear that it can scale. It can continue to grow at the pace that it's growing and maintain itself as sort of an authoritative resource for people on the net. So that's part of that's an example of sort of an application, if you will, at the application layer, a scaling problem there. I think the hard thing in thinking about the net is keeping track of all these layers. Each one has its own sort of growth dynamic and interacting with the layers on top. I think that the lower levels of the protocol stack are particularly important because everything rides on those. You know, we don't have an internet if it's not routing correctly anymore, if the DNS breaks down, you don't have a single global the communications platform anymore. So there's reason I'm more worried about that, I guess, than I am about things at the higher level of the stack, but not because they're more interesting or more difficult. They're just more fundamental, I think, in that sense.
Here in the front.
I'm Alexa McCray. I'm at the Harvard Medical School, and I'm particularly interested in the intersection between open access, the internet, copyright law, and publishers. And I wondered whether you have any insight.
Four dimensions, but I'll
exactly.
Try to keep them
well,
in my head.
And whether you have any insight into what the future is going to look like. Certainly, copyright law, and particularly the way it's being applied today, was created in a print world where it was important for, we needed to have publishers because publishers disseminated for us. We no longer need publishers for the dissemination aspect of, I'm particularly interested, of course, in scholarly communication. We no longer need the publishers. They, of course, don't see it that way, and they're taking folks to court and so on.
You know, what the future is going to look like. As the old saying has it, you know, there's nothing harder to predict than the future. So I don't know what the future of copyright looks like. One of the, again, the sort of the subtext of the book, if you will, or my thinking about cyberspace is to try to have people, at least as a thought experiment, to start fresh. Suppose we didn't have the copyright law we already have, and now we have this new place, which is different than the old place in some very important ways that are quite relevant to copyright law, namely, copying is very easy and distribution is profoundly easy in various ways. What kind of copyright law would we have in that place if we started with nothing? And I think, you know, Yochai's, the points Yochai makes in his book are very relevant to that. And as we've learned something about, at least in this place, about how creativity proceeds. It does not seem to need the same kind of copyright law, if you will. It has been sort of roundly disregarded by most of the people who are creating things on the net. So that needs, we would take that into account, I think, if we were starting fresh. And designing a copyright law that actually made sense for a networked environment. Now, I don't know what that looks like or how we get there from here, which is a problem of power and politics and all the rest. But it's worth thinking about, I think it is worth thinking about, what would it look like if we could implement something new? Copyright is the Jeffersonian insight on that to me. Is that there really are two kinds of people in the world with respect to copyright, and we're going to have to deal with that in a global place. One, Jeffersonians have a particular view of intellectual property. It is a utilitarian and instrumental view of intellectual property. We only want intellectual property if it helps people to create. That's the goal. I think it is fair to say right now, on the net, copyright law is not doing that. It's not helping. It's an understatement, right? To the Jeffersonian, that means sort of get rid of it. Get rid of it. There is another view. There is a sort of a moral rights, a natural rights view. I mean, Jefferson spent a lot of time saying the right to intellectual property is not a natural right. It is a social right. We give it to you because we think it will incentivize people to create, but if it doesn't, get rid of it. There's a significant alternative view, and everybody thinks, I used to read that stuff and go, who cares, you know, natural right, who cares, natural law, that's so old-fashioned. But in fact, that debate is quite critical to what's going on in the net, because many people believe that it actually is a natural right, that there's part of your personality when you create something, and that you have sort of a continuing interest, a personal interest in your work as it moves around the internet. I mean, French copyright law is based upon that, and there are many people in the United States who sort of, if you scratch them, you find actually they also believe that. In all the debates about copyright law, you'll hear people, it's just not fair to take somebody's work and send it around. There's a strong element of that. Somehow that's going to, that needs to be
recognized. Of course, if anybody has a natural right, it's the author, it's not the publisher.
Correct.
I just might add that.
The question is whether the author can sign away that right. I mean, if it is a natural right, as in French copyright law, you can't sign it away. It's an inalienable right to certain things about your work, to have your work attributed to you and to preserve its integrity. And no matter what you sign, it can't go away. That's a very important, I don't think those two are really reconcilable, quite frankly, which is one reason why I think the UN or an international treaty is not going to solve this problem. because there's no position that sort of reconciles these two. You need places where the different rules apply. People want to who believe that, you know, God bless them. They should have an environment where they are free to design laws that implement their view of what the world is like, and I want to be free to design laws that implement my view of the world, which is a different one.
At times, there's been calls for sort of a constitutional convention for cyberspace, pitched usually as an alternative to either the UN or individual sovereigns regulating. I think we maybe see it most closely now coming not from law types, but from technical types like David Clark at MIT and his project with the AAAS, the Clean Slate Project at Stanford, which garners a lot of press and publicity because it says, yeah, what if we were starting over again with what we know? What would we do? And I'm curious, first, what you think about those projects, the self-conscious attempt to figure out how to govern those pieces of the space that do need to be common so you can't just kind of have a federalist idea about it. And second, if you were present at some kind of clean slate meeting, what would your charge to the body be? What would you think of as most important to keep in mind?
Yeah, those are hard. Isn't that hard? I think they may be I've been involved in some of those sort of the constitutional moment, constitutional calls. They may be premature, actually. I'm beginning to think that they are. One of the things that I think is may be happening, and I think helped along by this book, because I've been in touch with some people who are talking now, not so much about a constitutional convention. I don't have a good picture of what the Constitution would look like and how we ratify it and who we're writing it for and who represents whom, and but rather a call to a sort of netizenship, the citizenship in this place. Not obviously in lieu of one's citizenship in real space, but as a means of sort of civic engagement, of taking seriously this as a place where law happens, as it were, where important things happen, and that needs to be governed, and that to sort of a commitment on the part of people to take it seriously. What I would do at the clean slate, yeah, I'd start with copyright is what I would do at the clean slate. I think that's the area in which it is clear that in which you could get a consensus among a significant number of people who are netizens, if you will, that the system is profoundly broken, that it really does not work anymore, and that we need a new paradigm to govern the sharing.
But that's a legal paradigm rather than a technical paradigm.
I don't know whether that's a good question. I don't know whether it is a legal paradigm or a technical question, or like so many other things on the net, some sort of weird hybrid between the two that has sort of a technical component. But I think you could get a discussion going about that, and you could get a consensus about changes that are necessary, including perhaps respect for existing copyrights could be part of that. I mean, I think that does need to be part of the discussion in some way, but not in a way that sort of chokes off the creativity. That's what I would think we could bite that off, because we know what we're talking about. We have a common vocabulary for that, and it doesn't involve overtly questions of sort of governance and constitutions that are very hard to visualize at this early stage in the development. I mean, the other thing, it's really nice to go back and a couple of hundred years and sort of look forward to realize, it helps one realize that we're at the very beginning of this thing. I mean, nothing's off the table. We're going to be talking about these for 100 years or more if we're lucky. If we're not all foraging for roots and berries in a couple of years as everything goes to hell in a handbasket. We'll be talking about these issues for a long time. This is the early stages. This thing has just begun. So there's an opportunity to sort of say, what do we want this to look like down the road? I think Ethan has a, yeah. Oh, David.
David Weinberger.
Do you worry that if there were actually a founding moment, a constitutional moment that's global, that it might precipitate exactly the opposite of what you and I want? So that at this moment, that's the moment at which, let's say, the Taliban decides that the protocol, right at the protocol level, right. The internet is broken because it allows for free speech. It allows for the transmission of bits without any control at the bit level or further up the stack for controlling the bits on the basis of their content. And that given a chance, bring the world together to talk about this, to come forward with a constitution might actually change the basic technical nature of the internet so that it conforms to political philosophies that perhaps we don't all share.
That's a profound point and a profound problem. I know, and I've thought a lot about this. I used to think about this, David, when during the ICANN war, the DNS wars of the late 1990s, when they were forming ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, which to manage the domain name system, this sort of overtly quasi-political body, global in scope. The domain name system had run very well when no one was paying attention. It was actually run by one person, in effect, up until about 1995, 96. It was doing fine. When it was in the shadows, it was purring along quite well. Shining the light on it, suddenly everybody who's got a stake in it, which is kind of everybody in the world, started paying attention to it. And of course, it brings out of the corners, the big money interests get very involved, they go to the meetings, they hire their lawyers, they hire the lobbyists. It's very easy to twist it and turn it into a way. Whereas if we could just shut up about it, maybe it would just have kept sort of purring along. But there comes a moment where you sort of can't, you know, it's the cat was out of the bag. We're talking about it, so you try to talk about it in an intelligent way. But I think that's it's an aspect of the problem. I don't know what one does about that. I guess I have a Jeffersonian faith, belief, something between belief and faith, that more discussion is always preferable to less about everything. Could be wrong about that. That's why it's faith. I can't persuade you of that, but I think I do believe that, that in the final analysis, you have to shine the light as best you can and take your chances that you will lose those battles or that the people of the world will fundamentally disagree with you about that. That's
Lewis.
So in a certain sense, I think there's about to be a constitutional convention around copyright, which is the Google Book Settlement.
Yes, yeah.
And so two questions. One is, wouldn't that be an example of the kind of ad hoc rulemaking that you're imagining? Here, two parties have agreed on something, and they show up, and the court should just say, give them their blessing?
Which is probably what the court will do.
Or if not... If you had to a seat at the table and could change one thing about that settlement, what would you change?
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't want to shoot my mouth off without having thought that through a little more carefully. I'm okay with shooting my mouth off, but on that one, I'm not sure I want to. I think the Google Book Settlement, though,
what would Jefferson do?
Right, that's always all right. I just say what. It's like the dummy on my knee. I can make him talk. The thing about the Google settlement, the book settlement is it too illustrates an interesting scaling problem, if you will. It's not too, there are not two parties who have an interest in this. There are 40 million, give or take, because everybody's ever written a book that Google would like to scan and put on. Now that, you know, the Publishers Association doesn't represent that. Everybody, doesn't it represent really a fraction of the people whose interests might be implicated by this? And in fact, that's going to be the big legal issue, I think, over the next year or so, is whether a court is going to accept that purely on sort of technical class action grounds. Whose rights are they signing away, and where did they get the ability to do that? There are too many people who have an interest in this, in a sense, to make this a model for large-scale governance, but I'm perfectly happy. I was always perfectly happy. It's like the Creative Commons model, which is another interesting sort of quasi-governance experiment with people contractually indicating what they think the appropriate response should be or the appropriate actions that can be taken with respect to their works. I have no problem with that. I think the problem with the scaling of that as a governance model is pretty serious, because there are a lot of people who have not consented to that, and who's so you can't really give away their rights.
And you've generally been okay with private agreements among people that could end up affecting non-parties. I mean, the famous real-time black hole list, where a guy named Paul Vixie just started keeping a list of people whom he believed to be spammers. Big entities and corporations subscribed to his list, so if Paul didn't like you, your email wasn't getting to a lot of people on the net.
Right, right. And I still think that is actually a very an interesting and important kind of model for a kind of governance, because nobody was coerced into buying into Paul's list. Paul's, you know, it was just a list that he posted on the net, and
but if
it
I'm...
only was authoritative to the extent that people signed onto it. It's very much like the DNS. It's like the root. The root's just the root that controls all of the internet naming and numbering. The great root. It's just it's a 2K text file that we could all copy and do whatever we want with. It's authoritative because people point to it and treat it as authoritative. It's the same thing with Vixie's list. If he's screwing around, if he's taking people off that shouldn't be taken off, the system has the ability to correct for that. The system has the ability to correct for that in a way, not perfectly, but in a way that I think is reasonably responsible.
And I suppose, ditto if Google makes a decision to delist somebody from the search engine, that you get the Google death penalty.
Is this a trick question he's asking me? I mean, look, you know, Jefferson didn't like concentrations of power, and we should all be wary of concentrations of power, governmental power or non-governmental power. Google, obviously, I mean, obviously being delisted from Google.
But it's just a, 10,000 terabyte hallucination.
Correct. It is just a 10,000 terabyte hallucination. It can have serious consequences because it is, at the moment, the search engine of choice, but of course there will always be at the moment a search engine of choice. Mm. I'm old enough, not you young, to remember time before there was Google, when it was we were all worried about what Alta Vista was doing. And I remember the time before that when we were all worried about what CompuServe was doing. So I don't know that Google continues to play this role necessarily in the future, but it is troublesome to the extent that it does. Aggregations of private power are also worrisome.
Yeah.
I think that's a Jeffersonian, that's an important Jeffersonian principle too. And if sometimes I have neglected that, as I think I have at times in the past, or paid that short shrift, that's probably a mistake.
I never did finish that Who Runs Gopher Anyway paper. I'm probably a little late now. For a last question, Ethan Zuckerman.
So sitting in a room of lawyers and proto-lawyers, it seems only logical that we're going to end up with conversations about a constitutional moment. I'm wondering why this conversation doesn't start a little bit earlier, which is with a revolution, and essentially a throwing over of existing power structures that gives you that open space to have that constitutional moment. And I guess what I'm wondering in all of this is, where is the revolution coming from? When do people decide that, a la Yochai, we can't just keep muddling along within the system, that things have to be very different? It seems to me that what's been happening sort of in recent history is a lot of badly failed rebellions. Facebook issues a fiat. We've all got very different rights. There's a very brief rebellion. Facebook issues a slightly different fiat. But I've yet to see people sort of stand up and say, no, we must find a way to govern ourselves. And I guess what I'm curious about here is, when do we get to that point where that rebellion actually leads us into this constitutional moment? Is it Pirate Bay? Is it when Facebook decides that they're going to start building advertising using all of our faces and monetizing and selling products to all of our lists? What would actually get us to the point where we sort of break out of this structure and towards one of these constitutional moments?
You have a fervid imagination. I want to hear more of the parade of horribles, so then I can pick one from among the... I think it's part of why it, in a sense, may be premature and, in a sense, is in the early days. When people are spending more of their time and earning more of their income and meeting more of their friends and listening to more of their music and living more of their lives in cyberspace, if you will, online, then I think they care more about the rules under which they live. I hope they do. Maybe that hasn't happened yet. I mean, maybe that just has not happened yet. And I think it's close. We all know people spend a lot of time who are deeply invested in their online lives. But it's still, I think, at the periphery of most people's lives. And the less that's true, it seems to me, the more likely it is that you do have the possibility of sort of a rebellious moment in which something happens that really matters to people. That's what's that hits them where they live, if you will, in a way that they don't think, you're just talking about, I wish they would, extend Scrubs for another year, but I'm not going to get all, excited about that. When they move to a different category where it's, how you will live and earn your living and meet your friends and go to school and all the rest, that you people do care about. And then when there's a move in some hardening or oppressive direction, I think there becomes a chance, perhaps, that large numbers of people, you reach that tipping point where large numbers of people say, we're not going to take this anymore.
So with that call to antlers, I decree us adjourned. Please join me in thanking David Post for...